Show Me the Way, episode 20, the GC's M&A. In this episode, we talk with Chuck Williams about his experience as senior vice president and general counsel of a large national specialty contractor, Performance Contracting Group. Proud to say they are located in my home city of Kansas City. But we're going to talk to him specifically about the strategy and process that guided his company when acquiring businesses and the success Performance Contracting Group had in adding tuck-ins to their platform company. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, and Business Succession Planning, the Merger and Acquisition Experience, and Successful Exits. I'm your host, Dave Sider. Before we dive into today's captivating discussion, for any of you podcast listeners out there, I have a feeling you'll be interested in the upcoming BEI National Exit Planning Conference taking place this August in one of my favorite spots of the world, Denver, Colorado. And to top it off, I will be speaking along with an esteemed panel of top-notch M&A advisors, investment bankers, and financial advisors. Together, we will delve into the current landscape and latest trends we are seeing in the M&A marketplace. If you are eager to be part of this conversation, please mark your calendars and make sure to join us at BEI National Exit Planning Conference this August. Details are available at BEI.com. And with that, let's shift our focus back to the discussion at hand. Joining me today on today's show is a guy I have known for over 20 years, Chuck Williams. Chuck is going to share his experiences and insights in his role as general counsel and as a member of his company's acquisition team. And we'll discuss issues such as choosing the right acquisition target or candidate, negotiating and strategizing with acquisition target owners, and the process of integrating the target company's human resources to ensure a successful transaction. What I'm going to be interested in listening to is Chuck's observations from the buy side on what a buyer's looking for. Now, that's important for two reasons. If you are a buyer, you're going to compare and contrast what you're doing with what Chuck's company is doing, what Chuck did in the performance of his job. If you're the sell side, you want to know what the buyer is thinking and how they go about making decisions. So we got a couple of wins going on here, and I imagine we're going to have several lessons learned that you'll be able to take away and use in your next acquisition. So without further ado, Chuck, great to talk to you. Glad that you could make some time. Let's kick it off here a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? Let's just start with, where in the name of God's green earth were you born and where were you raised? Where did you go to college? Yeah, let the people get to know you a little bit.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. And hi, and thanks for letting me join you today. I'm really excited about this. I was raised on the Florida Gulf Coast, and I had a pretty traditional upbringing as a suburban kid in the 60s and 70s. I graduated from the College of William & Mary in the late 70s with a degree in the liberal arts, which I've always believed is an incredibly important discipline.
Or as we say here in Kansas, it's Libby Arts degree time. But yes,
Libby
please.
Arts degree time. Well, it to me is just a way of teaching you how to solve problems and think critical philosophy into my law school years at Florida State University. My approach was then and still is, like I said, that law school to me was basically a trade school for critical thinking and problem solving. Mm-hmm. And that philosophy, I think, has served me well in my legal career. I started working for a boutique law firm, had about 15 attorneys, and they specialized in the construction industry. This law firm was primarily a litigation firm, but they had one partner who was a business attorney, and that's who I worked with. I had always preferred to work with clients solving problems and strategically thinking and business planning rather than going to court and being a litigator.
Chuck, did you always work with just construction companies when you're in the firm, or were you able to work with other folks in other industries?
At this firm, I worked in the construction industry exclusively. That was our clientele. But we had all sorts of contractors, generals, subs, specialty contractors, and many different areas of construction, too. So it was a pretty varied clientele. And I found very, very quickly that I really enjoyed working with contractors. That was a real pleasure to work with them. They're generally good salt of the earth people. And I was very fortunate, very lucky, and very happy to work with construction clients. So I'm at the firm, been there about 3 years, mid-80s, and we represented the management of the construction division of a large publicly held manufacturing company in a spinoff of that division where the division management formed a separate and privately owned independent company. And this opportunity for someone about 4 years out of law school was a tremendous growth and learning opportunity for me. And I was really fortunate to have that experience. So we got the transaction done. It was very successful. And over the course of the next 10 years, I represented this client as an outside counsel in many and varied business matters. I did contract reviews, joint ventures, construction and business disputes, you know, you name it, any number of different things. And over the course of that representation, I began to realize that I much preferred the thought of working in-house rather than as an outside counsel. I wanted to be part of the everyday business strategies and decisions rather than simply being called on an as-needed basis.
How did you like handling billable hours, Mr. Williams?
I loved not having billable hours. No. You canceled that. That wasn't your question.
you answered it well.
Dave, you're right. One of the things about private practice that I really hated was billable hours. That wasn't the best thing about moving in-house, but it certainly was in the top five. So, and it's interesting because it really was just blind, dumb luck that I got introduced to this company. As I worked with this company, over the course of the next 10 years, I realized what I wanted my career path to be. I wanted to work in-house. And so I worked really hard to, in essence, make my own luck. Mm-hmm. In 1994, I was given the opportunity to join the company as their first general counsel and start their in-house legal department. And of course, I jumped at it. And over the next 20 years, I got to realize my dream job, participating with this company that prided itself on ethical excellence and success for its customers, its partners, and employees. It was really a fantastic opportunity. And I have always thought that I was one of the lucky ones who got to spend 20 years doing really something that he really loved and felt good about.
So you became, well, let's try drill down a little bit. You became an in-house counsel, but I know you. To say you're an in-house counsel is a very restrictive definition, right? You are more than that.
You're right, Dave. In addition to all of the legal matters I got to work on, I was very involved in a lot of the business issues, the internal corporate issues, the human resource issues. I got to be involved in a wide variety of legal and business issues that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to be involved in as an outside counsel. As an outside counsel, when you get called in on a specific matter, you're very much pigeonholed, and you have a very narrow focus for that specific problem that the client has talked to you about. I found that when I joined the company, I learned that I did not know that much about the company's inner workings, not as much as I thought that I did. And it was one of the great pleasures of the job to really learn about the business itself. And quite frankly, made me a much better general counsel because the more I knew about my company, my client, the better I was able to give them holistic advice. I was able to recognize and be involved and solve issues that might otherwise not have come to the fore if I didn't know the business and was involved with the business on a day-to-day basis. So that was a large part of the fun of being general counsel too.
It always seemed to me that the general counsel, and I say this from an outside counsel point of view, the general counsel, the good ones, really understood the business almost first. and the law was an adjunct versus the other way around. I mean, those are the guys like you that I thought really have it figured out, because they're trying to always get the law to work for the business, not the business to work for the law.
That's exactly right. So often as an outside counsel, your first instinct is to tell the client, this is what you have to do. And you're only thinking of it from a legal perspective. When I was working with the management, and then when we would have to engage outside counsel, and you and I have a lot of experience with this, it was critically important that I know the business and I know what the business goal is of that particular matter, so that I can translate that to you and I can guide you. This is the result we want. This is the goal we're trying to achieve. And with my knowledge of the business and my knowledge of the law, I think that helps you as outside counsel do a much better job and give us the representation and the planning and the strategies that we really were looking for.
That said it very concisely. That was perfect. Let's pivot a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the strategies, considerations that you undertook as general counsel and a member of the C-suite when looking at acquisitions.
Sure. I'd love to talk to you about how our company made growth decisions, specifically our acquisition vision, strategy, and implementation. We did a fair number of these, and over time, we developed a successful template for our acquisition process based on who we were, where we wanted to go, and how we wanted to get there. And we developed templates that evolved to meet our specific needs and processes because of who we were. We were a large national specialty contractor, about 50 profit centers around the country, with a core of 3 or 4 specialties. So we had to decide what our acquisition strategy was going to be and how it fits into our existing structure and how our structure would evolve with those acquisitions.
And I think for the listeners, Chuck, what's important is for those trying to figure out how this fits into their business, this is a buy-side analysis. So if you're a seller, you want to know the secret sauce, what a buyer's thinking. And you're offering up the secret sauce. If you're even on the buy side, you're always interested in, well, how do other buyers do it? Am I doing it the right way? Is there a better way? So if that's what you bring to the table. So I share that with the listeners as they hear what Chuck is saying, so they can compare and contrast if you're on the buy side. And you always want to know what in the name of God's green earth is the buyer thinking about if you're on the sell side. So it's had many applications. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And some of the things I'll talk about will be pretty universal.
Okay.
Some of the things that I talk about as far as our template and our process might seem a little peculiar, but we developed them to fit our specific needs and they ended up working very well for us.
But that is so important, Chuck. That is so important because what you've done, see, here's another key point. I apologize for stepping on your words. The buyers that I see are successful know who they're going after. They have a specific plan. I can show people 100 different deals, okay? And I'm wasting their time. It's more important to know exactly what you're going after and what you need. So great insight.
You've got to know what your strategy is and know who your acquisition candidate profiles are, or else you'll spin your wheels. More often than not, the transaction won't go through or will fail for some reason, or it won't be successful. So you really do have to do your internal homework very, very much before you start the process to know exactly what you want the acquisition to accomplish. So our strategy was typically to acquire a smaller local or regional company, and usually with revenues of $10 million to $30 million, so not huge, but we would use those to fold or otherwise enhance our existing businesses. And we often used acquisitions to expand our range of specialties.
At the end of the day, was this the criteria you set out or set up front? Or is this the criteria that evolved over time as you undertook acquisition? I mean, I've had people come in and go, let's say I want to buy something. How big? I don't know. I think I know the space, but I don't know. What amount of earnings? The people who have done a lot of acquisitions know exactly what they're looking for, exactly how much they want to spend, exactly in what area is best they can tell. Now, that doesn't always work out. You may not find somebody in that marketplace, but I don't know that anyone figures that out up front. You have a general idea. It's going through the process and buying entities and being successful. And frankly, more often than not, failing. Because you really learn something, you know what doesn't work.
That's the first acquisitions we did after I became general counsel was we bought another fairly large company that had 30 branches all over the Southeast. And this acquisition actually increased our revenues by 50%. It was a huge transaction for us. It ultimately was successful, but it took a few years to really integrate the company the way that we wanted to do. And it drained so many of our other resources that although it ultimately ended up being a successful acquisition, it was a lot of work. And we decided we wanted to bite smaller bites in the future. And we wanted to look at smaller acquisition targets on a very specific basis to meet more specific needs of our core businesses, our branches, and our locations.
All right, here's a huge lesson learned. Huge lesson learned. That one rule should apply across the board. You know, I'm not a proponent of mergers for that reason, okay? And what I mean is usually a merger is a combination of about the same size. So first of all, somebody's got to dominate. And number two, that's a lot for somebody to take on. You want to choose small bites and figure out how to bring them in. Because at the end of the day, and I see this over and over and over again with sellers, and that is, you know, if they're going to stick around with the company, they think it's business as usual. It's never business as usual. You're going to evolve into the new culture. And if you don't have that culture well established, it makes that combination that much more difficult. So I think you hit on a huge lesson learned for people, whichever side you're on.
Oh, absolutely. You mentioned the word culture, and we're going to come back to that time and time again in this discussion, because I think the right cultural fit may be the most important part of the entire acquisition. So as we've been talking about, first and foremost, you've got to figure out why you wanted to incorporate an acquisition into your growth strategy.
Yes.
We have three main reasons. The first was perhaps to enter into a new market where we didn't have any permanent presence already. We wanted to increase our market share in an existing market. And we would want to expand into related specialties that would enhance and complement our existing core businesses. Now, I think everyone's specific industry and business will dictate certain other factors that you need to think about for your growth strategy as you look at these and that are unique to your business and industry. One thing that was very important to us was the location of the acquisition candidate. The geographic location in the area of the country where the acquisition candidate was very important for us. Certainly, location is always important. The general business environment in a particular locale is always of critical importance. But beyond the general business environment, we were looking for someplace with a very strong labor market because, as you know, the construction industry is labor intensive. So there had to be the presence of a good workforce, of a strong workforce. We had the additional factor that we were a union company and not a merit shop. So we could only look at acquisition candidates in locations where there was a strong union presence. And that obviously limited some of the scope of our geographical searches. But that's who we were, and that's who we knew we were, that's who we wanted to be. And that actually helped us narrow down our acquisition strategies and targets.
Very good. And that's been in place now for 25 years? 26 years, that philosophy?
Oh, yeah. Well, since the late 90s, quite frankly. Yeah. And I'm sure we're still following those same processes and procedures. I'm sure they've gotten even better and more refined. So our ideal acquisition profile, regardless of the reason for the acquisition, was generally the same. First, we always worked in some way with our acquisition candidate before we even started talking about an acquisition. We already knew the candidate and knew the owner before we even thought about an acquisition. Probably the most common way we would do this, we would form a joint venture with this company and work with them on a project or two, get to know them, get an initial feel for, was it a good cultural fit? How successful were they within their location? Was it going to be a complementary business for us? And then again, our typical candidate, more often than not, had an owner that was looking for some kind of an exit strategy after a successful career. This was almost always the situation in our acquisitions that we had this type of an owner. As you know, construction companies typically don't have a lot of hard assets. Their assets are their people. But because of that, it's going to be hard for a typical construction business owner to reap his reward by simply liquidating his business. He needs to be able to try to sell it as a going concern.
That business owner is needing to figure out how to sell his business as a going concern and to achieve the value that comes from having a going concern, not a liquidation.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Dave. Yes. We mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but culture was every bit as important to us in an acquisition candidate than was the expertise or the market share. The expertise, the market share, those are givens, but the greatest assets of a construction company are its people. You know, we were looking for a skilled workforce, both in the field and in the office. So in that sense, competence was a given. It was a prerequisite. However, the ability to integrate into our company's culture was of paramount and critical importance. We can change internal processes. We can change procedures. We can implement new controls once we complete the acquisition, but it's almost impossible to change a bad cultural fit.
Right. A bad penny is a bad penny.
That's exactly right. Yes. Yes. So very often, the owner of the acquisition was looking for an exit strategy, but the owner might not necessarily be ready to retire right then and there, any number of reasons why. But that actually, in most cases, worked to both of our advantages. Assuming a good cultural fit, a critical part of our company's acquisition process often included the owner staying in the business for another 1 or 2 years to help with the transition. The owner stayed involved in the business, looking after his or her baby, and was a cheerleader for the company to ensure better and a smoother transition. This also provided consistent management while we searched for a successor to head the acquired business. That successor might be somebody within the acquired company, or it might be someone from one of our other branches as an opportunity to grow in his or her career. So that transition period was always very, very beneficial. And rarely did we have conflicts with the owner who stayed after we made the acquisition. And I think a primary reason of that was because we established very early on a good cultural fit.
You know, that's kind of remarkable because I've done acquisitions where they've kept the seller in place and it's gotten contentious. And I would be willing to tell you that happens more often than not. So a lot of times my recommendation on the buy side is, and I tell sellers this, that they're probably going to move you out. And here's the reason why. It's hard once you're the owner to not be the owner. And it's hard once you're the owner to find yourself in a position you're taking instructions from someone else, especially as all former owners do, find the things they don't like. They won't remember, you know, the things that are really good about the new company. So it's awkward. So that's high praise for what you've done.
Yeah, we were very happy with the way that we could make that work. You got to find the right person, the right business owner with the right cultural fit, and you've got to share the same vision. And I think the owner staying just for 1 or 2 years is a good thing. If you have an owner who stays beyond that, the longer they stay, the more contentious it. We did have one situation where the owner stayed with us and became a long-term employee, and that worked out very, very well. But that's the exception, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the anomaly. But you raise one good point, and I'm going to take this away from our talk, and that is, if you can get 1 or 2 years out of them and everybody's pretty happy, that's a good deal. I mean, that's the exception, again, would be in my estimation. I see most owners, once the business relationships are transferred, that's about it, and they move on down the road. Anyway. Good. Yeah. Good. Another lesson learned. Ladies and gentlemen, we got 2 lessons learned so far for the price of 1 podcast.
Well, another thing, the typical candidate already had a very strong presence in the market, had a very positive reputation and strong connections within the construction industry and the community. We were absolutely not interested in taking a struggling company and attempting a turnaround. We weren't looking to just simply increase market share without leveraging it to greater heights. We were looking to take an already strong local company and leverage it. For example, our company had very, very strong financial and project operational controls, more sophisticated than any of our acquisition candidates would have, primarily because, again, of our size. And we could insert these processes, procedures, and controls into the candidate's already existing successful business and greatly increase efficiencies and profits. So I don't think that's necessarily all that unique, because I think the leveraging strategy and rationale is likely a universal factor in pretty much any acquisition and choosing the right candidate, no matter what the industry. You find a company that's successful, and you find ways to make it more successful.
Put it on steroids. Yeah. Good call. So I've got it. You've come up with some good ideas. You got 2 lessons learned on profiling and how to deal with the company you're acquiring. So let's fast forward. You now found the candidate. And again, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't happen overnight. But our thought process, I think, is that we go on from here. We found the candidate. Can you tell us about the process itself? Because I don't think they show up on the doorstep, here are the keys, you write a check, move on down the road.
Oh no.
A little more involved.
No matter how good the relationship is, there's a lot of work to do. I think the 3 buzzwords that I think of are due diligence, communication, and flexibility. Those, I think, are universal considerations in going through the process. And remember, it's okay to not finalize a transaction if these considerations reveal issues that can't be overcome, or if an informed analysis through their due diligence process concludes this isn't a right fit. Just because you've started the dance doesn't mean you can't stop. I think those deals that don't quite seem to fit, but the parties are so determined to make a deal that they force it through, that's a recipe for problems in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, either it's a marriage. I cannot tell you how many times I've seen them try to form fit it and go like, dude, this ain't going to happen. And it's not from the legal side. I'm just saying for the other reasons.
Absolutely.
Don't you find that, you know, if it's that contentious to put a deal together, it shouldn't be a deal we do.
That's exactly right. And we walked away from some. We had a pretty good success rate, I think, because we did a lot of homework before the process even started. Mm-hmm. But there's always surprises that come up in the negotiation and in the due diligence. And you always have to keep asking yourself, is this the right fit? Is this the right business fit? Is this the right cultural fit? And if it is, you keep going. If it's not, recognize it and move on.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got lesson number 3. Did you hear that? All right. Shoehorning is not an objective in an acquisition. Lesson number 3. Thank you. They're getting a big bag for their buck here. That's good.
Well, we didn't have the perfect process when we started, obviously. We evolved our process and we developed a very effective template for us. Some of the details might be very unique to our process due to our size and our culture and just the way we like to do these things. But there are some universal truths that can be learned regardless. Let's talk about due diligence.
Great.
This may be one of the things that was fairly unique to us.
Okay.
We developed an acquisition team in which about 24 of our internal corporate and operational professionals participated. We had areas of expertise such as financial, operational, human resources, benefits, risk management, legal. The people on the acquisition team had their day jobs. And then they were part of this acquisition team to make sure that we were looking under all of the rocks, to make sure that we were addressing all of the issues that were important both to us and to the seller. Now, we did use outside professionals when needed, but due to our size and the nature of our acquisition target profile, we were able to do the vast majority of the process in-house. This acquisition team would meet on a weekly basis and give reports on what they had done, what they had seen, any recommendations, and what was coming up for the next week to 2 weeks. So it was a very intensive operation, and these professionals really put in the extra hours during the due diligence period to make this a success. But it was a process that really ended up working very well to us.
For your company, you found there's a lot of ways to do due diligence, a lot of ways to put deals together. But for your company, you figured out the process, the people, and the procedure to put into place that worked for you. And I think to your point, everybody, and it's weird, every deal that I've seen as far as how they, from my vantage point, looks like from the business decision or legal decision or accounting decision or tax decision, everybody has a little different way to do it. Meaning you got to find what works for you, given your existing processes, your people, okay, what their skill sets are, and then the procedure that will allow that company to fit into what you're doing. It's not, you're not going to go to a shelf down at Barnes and Noble and pull a book off, you know, and it's going to apply, an M&A procedure is going to apply to how you do business. It's going to be as individualized as each company, because each company, they have different needs. You know, some people will look at it, you know, I got to have a multiple of a certain amount. I've got to have a margin of a certain amount. Or, you know, I'm invading the territory and I'm trying to knock out competitors. Or I need these employees. Or, you know, what is the or? What is it that you have to have? So you've designed over that time period something that works for you to make you successful. And it's as individualized as the company that you work for.
Absolutely. And this process developed over a period of time. We did not have this in place on our first acquisition. But we learned from our mistakes. We took our lessons learned and we improved the process. And the improving the process actually gave us the focus to find better acquisition candidates. Yep. And gave us a much greater chance of a successful acquisition. So we were very happy with the way we ultimately were able to figure out how to do it.
Lesson number four here, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, lesson number four here. You know, you don't have to be perfect at it, but get a little bit better every time. And by the way, the more you do, the better you get at it, typically.
That's exactly right. And remember also, we generally knew a good deal about this acquisition candidate before we started seriously talking. Positions. We never just went in and looked at the company and bought it. We had to work with them in the field, in the real world, before we would even consider talking about an acquisition.
You know, this is lesson number five, but really for Dave Sider, because this you taught me. I turned this over to a client. We did a very large nine-figure acquisition. And I asked him to go meet with the client 6 months in advance. They said, we want to do that. We go, you know, go get to know them, go live with them. You know, you really need to do that in order to really feel comfortable and understand them. And they said it was great advice. I go, well, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science for me. I learned from other people, namely you, and you get to understand then what they're all about. And, you know, it makes exiting, if you have to exit, a lot easier if you do that before signing an LOI, letter of intent, than after the money has left the bank. God, we got a lot of lessons here, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're writing this stuff down, that some of this could be really good someday.
Well, you know, once we got to the letter of intent stage, we knew there was going to be much more negotiation and we knew surprises were inevitable. But if we had done our due diligence, if we had developed a good relationship with the owner, if we had followed our process, we rarely failed to close the transaction in one way or the other.
The ones that you didn't do, why did you not do it? If there are any keys, I mean, it's hard to say. Each deal is different.
Maybe one reason we didn't quite do as much due diligence as we thought and I can get to this a little bit later. There were a couple of acquisitions that we did that were outside of our core businesses.
Okay.
We perhaps didn't know those businesses well enough. We perhaps thought we needed to add that to our core businesses. Maybe we thought that was more important than it turned out to be.
That's good insight. That's good insight. That helps. Because you're always trying to figure out. I think through life, you learn more from failures than you do from success. I think success at some level is a sedative, but you learn, you're going to get better stuff if you fail a couple of times, maybe only once, as long as you don't fail big.
Absolutely.
Don't be FTX.
Knowing the business, knowing the owner, before you really get too involved in the acquisition process, I think is of critical importance. In addition to the due diligence, communication is obviously absolutely critical. Constant and open communication. And so from the very start, we would carefully explain to the owner our entire process and expectations. And we had an open line of communication on anything with the owner throughout the entire process.
Excellent.
Here's one thing that might be very unique to our business. Once the letter of intent was signed, our goal was the close of the transaction in 45 days.
Unheard of. Ladies and gentlemen, unheard of. God love you.
Well, we were able to do that, I think, because of many factors. We knew what we wanted. We knew the candidate that we wanted, the type of candidate that we wanted. We focused on a certain size that made that manageable. We had an in-house team of 24 professionals who were 100% dedicated to this project.
You had a very specific plan that you executed. I mean, you had the resources, is what it sounds like.
We had the resources. And that might be one thing that makes it very unique for us, because not everybody's going to be able to have those in-house resources. No slight to you, but we found the more we could do things in-house as opposed to outside professionals, we were just able to do it faster and better.
Yep.
And, you know, this was a hectic time. A 45-day period is a very hectic time, lots of intense activity, but it was better for both our company and the acquisition candidate than 4 or 6 months of uncertainty and chaos. If you have a very large transaction like the one I mentioned earlier that increased our size by 50%, you can't do it in 45 days. It took us 6 months to do the transaction. And the longer things go, the more potential for problems. So in addition to this team and the time period, we had developed agreements and templates that dictated the structure of the transaction. We would go in and we knew the structure. We didn't really negotiate too much on the structure of the transaction. We would not do stock sales. We did asset sales for very specific reasons, not necessarily unique to the construction industry, but that was just the model that worked for us. And we rarely deviated from the basic principles of that template, although we know that the details were always directed to the peculiar aspects of any particular transaction. So it's not quite as cookie cutter as it sounds, but we did have a process. We had a structure. We had a team. We had a time frame. We had open communication. So we had the flexibility, and all those things together evolved into what we end up thinking was a very, very successful strategy. Now, in addition to talking to the owner, we would also spend hours talking to the owner's employees. The owner was always there if you wanted to be. We always had the owner's consent to talk to the employees, but we had very specific and detailed conversations with the employees of the acquiring of the, but we had very detailed conversations with the employees of the candidate. We wanted to evaluate their expertise, their commitment, their cultural fit, again, very important of these prospective employees. Speed was critical in our experience to avoid the rumor mill, to set expectations, and gauge whether there needed to be any personnel changes for whatever reason, and to make the prospective new employees as comfortable as possible with our company. We would talk to them about salaries, benefits, culture, you know, the works. And we found that we did need to weed a few people out here and there. Sometimes they would say, well, you know, I just don't want to work that hard. or I just don't want to learn new things. And you could tell very quickly whether there was going to be a cultural fit or not. Now, talking to the employees also, we got to know whether there was potential for future leaders of that branch.
Yeah.
Or even very often, after a certain period, we would take certain employees from that company, from that acquired company, and send them to another branch in our company, another location, another business. And it created great pathways for successful careers for the employees of the acquired company. So we've talked about due diligence. We've talked about communication. Now let's just mention flexibility real quickly. Throughout the LOI due diligence process, new information and surprises always come up, and the deal has to be modified. That seems to be inevitable.
Correct.
Things might include price, employee retention issues, the progress of ongoing projects to be transitioned, something that may be a little bit unique to the construction industry. Customer relationships. We would go and talk to the customers of that candidate. The owner obviously would go with us. Sometimes we found that the customer relationship discussions were trickier sometimes than employee conversations. But if we'd done the proper due diligence and we'd communicated properly with the owner and his or her employees, any issues that inevitably came up were almost always addressed to the mutual benefit of both sides. Addressing and resolving the issues in this way also increased the spirit of trust between the two parties. And that allowed the parties to deal with issues that may have been very, very difficult without the open communication, without the trust, without the due diligence, and without the cultural fit. Also, if we were trying to do the acquisition within the time frame that our template demanded, there were obviously going to be things that we didn't discover. No amount of due diligence is going to uncover every possible problem. And so there had to be some element of trust and cooperation to address things that inevitably would come up after the acquisition was complete. And again, culture, so vitally important to make that part of the deal work.
Ladies and gentlemen, there is so much content here. We could do four parts to this, Chuck, very, very easily. I'm going to cut it off here. Why? There is so much that we've learned here. I am going to freeze frame this. The lessons learned, we got five, count them, go back through all five that we have here. I'm going to ask Chuck to come back. I'm asking a lot of him. Thank you, Chuck, for doing this. But I'm going to ask him to come back now, kind of wrap this up and go into some specific stories. Everybody loves stories. So we're going to do some stories for you. And we're going to have two or three big takeaways. So stay tuned to the next edition of Chuck Williams and the GC's M&A. Until next time. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, please, each and every business owner should consult with their attorney or trusted advisor on their distinct circumstances.